Dhyanam bhajate yam sri Parasparsha sayasakriti Svatma dosha pavargina Dadyajnajanamohini Hitva, giving up, anyan, others, bhajati, worships, yam, the Lord, sri, goddess of fortune, padasparsha, for the touch of his lotus feet, hasaya, with the desire, asakrit, constantly, svatma, of herself, dosha, the faults, apavargena, putting aside, tat is yachna, begging, jump, ordinary humans, mohini, bewildering. Translation, hoping for the touch of his lotus feet, the goddess of fortune perpetually worships him alone, leaving aside all others and renouncing her pride and fickleness. That he begs is certainly astonishing to everyone. Purport, the Supreme Master of the goddess of fortune herself obviously does not have to beg for food, as pointed out here by the Brahmanas, who are finally manifesting real spiritual intelligence. Translation, hoping for the touch of his lotus feet, the goddess of fortune perpetually worships him alone, leaving aside all others and renouncing her pride and fickleness. That he begs is certainly astonishing to everyone. Here again, the Brahmanas are speaking about the nature of the Supreme Lord. And what is astonishing is that the Lord begged food from them, which was rather unexpected, since, as is explained here, the Lord actually has the goddess of fortune serving him in great humility. Shri, of course, refers to generally Lakshmi, and the term in general, Shri, means wealth and beauty, opulence, great powers, etc. So it means an abundance of many wonderful things. And as far as a person is concerned, it refers to Lakshmi, generally Lakshmi, sometimes to Durga Devi, as we have the Shri Antaras for Durga Devi. But generally, in the Bhagavatam, Shri is used to denote Lakshmi. And Lakshmi denotes generally the wife of Vishnu. And of course, in India, Lakshmi means literally money. And of course, we use that term in ISKCON. Also, Lakshmi means money. When there's a picture of Lakshmi, generally the picture of Lakshmi is there because people worship Lakshmi for wealth. So they'll have Ganesh and Lakshmi in their business people will have Ganesh and Lakshmi in their business establishment. One to get rid of the obstacles in business and one to get the money. So Lakshmi is very famous. And Lakshmi is equated with Shri. That, of course, is, we can say, a secondary aspect of the spiritual Shri Lakshmi, because in the spiritual world, money doesn't matter at all anyway. But we can say that a Shri, of course, is the bestower of all sorts of benedictions in the spiritual world as well, in Vaikuntha, being the consort of Vishnu. Lakshmi Devi, just as Radha has the power to give mercy to devotees so they can attain Krishna. So, in Vaikuntha, Lakshmi Devi bestows mercy to the persons in order that they may attain the shelter of the lotus feet of Vishnu. So she has a very similar function. In any case, she has great powers. And from the material point of view, yes, she does have the ability to bestow all money and wealth and all sorts of benedictions upon the living entities. Though, Generally, we also attribute that to what we call the material Lakshmi and expansions of Durga Devi. But ultimately, they're all coming from Lakshmi. So these brahmanas here, of course, are talking about the material world. And they, of course, are condemning the fact that they are involved in household life and attached to all the results, etc. So here they're talking also about the material aspects of worship of the Lord. So if the Supreme Lord has Lakshmi as his consort, then he has all wealth at his command. So why would the Lord beg? Because he has all wealth already. So that is very surprising. So how is it that the Lord could actually come and beg from us, since he is the Supreme Lord and Shri is Shri, or the embodiment of all wealth, is at his worshipping him at his lotus feet and trying to give all service to him. In other words, if one worships the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Lord possesses everything, and therefore why would he, the Supreme Lord himself, want anything from anybody and actually beg from anybody? So yes, it is impossible. But though that is so, at the same time we should understand that there are ultimately contradictions in the activities of the Lord. And what may seem impossible or unlikely for the Lord to do, the Lord will do those things at certain times. And usually it is in response to his devotees. So the Lord is all-powerful, and he has all wealth, and he has all abilities, etc. Yet, we see for his devotees, he will show no power, as in the case of mother and father, Yasoda and Nanda. Krishna shows himself as powerless. And mother Yasoda and Nanda, they think of him as a small child who needs care and protection, and they have to do everything for him. So he is the object of mercy, even though he's the Supreme Lord. The Lord is the giver of all mercy. Yet he becomes the object of mercy for his devotees. So he takes the opposite role. Why? Because of the affection of his devotees. He accepts that role. And though he has all powers, he agrees to be tied up by Mother Yasoda. Though he will not be tied up by Gyanis and Yogis and Karmis or anybody else in this material world, he agrees to be tied up, literally tied up, with the rope by Mother Yasoda. Why? Because of his affection. When he sees Mother Yasoda is getting exhausted but will not give up trying to tie him up, then he agrees, I don't want to exhaust her anymore. And she has great affection for me and wants to tie me up out of affection, therefore I will be tied up. So again, out of affection for his devotee, the Lord will do what is contradictory normally to his nature. So in this way he's bound up. Or we can say the Lord is, as I mentioned yesterday, the Lord has no hunger and thirst. Yet, of course, here he is showing hunger by begging from the brahmanas, please give us some food, we are hungry. And from Mother Yasoda, he's saying, I'm hungry now, you have to feed me some milk. So therefore Mother Yasoda stops churning the yogurt and puts Krishna on her lap and feeds him milk. So that hunger and thirst again is, we can say, impossible in the spiritual world and impossible for Krishna. Yet he exhibits hunger and thirst. Why? In response to Mother Yasoda's affection, because she wants to feed him. So that's her nature as a devotee, is to feed Krishna. And therefore Krishna will have hunger and be fed by Mother Yasoda. And Krishna is, of course, in the Upanishads it says that the Supreme Lord is such that the wind and the sun and the moon are all afraid of the Supreme Lord. Out of the fear of the Supreme Lord, everything moves. Everything is moving because of the Supreme Lord. Everything is under his control. So the Lord is puts fear in everybody else, and he is fearless. But yet, Krishna shows fear. He shows fear of Mother Yasoda. We see in the Dhamma Dharmastika, there's a description of Krishna. And he has, out of fear, he has tears in his eyes. And the tears are coming down, and all of the kajal on his eyes is running down because of all the tears. Tears of fear. So even Krishna becomes afraid, even though he is God. And who is he afraid of? Just a mother. Just a mother with a stick. And Krishna, of course, is controlling all the universes and everything. And he's just afraid of Mother Yasoda with a little stick. Why is that? Again, out of response to Mother Yasoda. I mean, he's doing this. This is how the child is expected to act. So he acts like that. It's for Mother Yasoda. To show that he is a real good child, and he cries when and gets fearful when Mother Yasoda threatens him. So in this way, the Supreme Lord often shows contrary qualities to what we'd expect. And this is, of course, outstanding in Krishna. We will not see that so much in the other forms. They are showing powers of God, and that is their nature, to show powers, etc. But with Krishna, there's a big difference. And Krishna, on the other hand, shows himself as powerless, as a small child, etc. And he is the son of Mother Yasoda and Nanda. He has friends who are equals to him. So he will show many, many different qualities, which will look contrary to the nature of God. However, how do we solve this problem that Krishna is fearless but fearful and powerful but powerless, etc.? We should not think that Krishna is only playing a role and he's pretending to be powerless, or he's pretending to be fearful. Because if it's all pretend, then he's only acting like that for Mother Yasoda, but actually he's something else. So that would be a little bit of a deception. So then all of the acts that Krishna does and all the emotions he feels in relation to the devotees are actually deceptions. And he doesn't feel like that. No. Can't say that either. So we should not say that this is only an appearance of Krishna when he is fearful or powerless, etc. Krishna exactly identifies with those roles. And he becomes a small child. In spite of the fact that he is the Lord and he is the master of the universe, he is the universal form, etc. So how is it possible he can be so schizophrenic or whatever and have two opposite personalities? And the answer to that is that Krishna has achintya shakti, or inconceivable powers, by which these opposites can exist within him. This is the power of the Supreme Lord. And so he can have all these different qualities within himself. So in this particular verse, we have an expression of the fact that why does the Lord beg? Because he's actually got the goddess of fortune at his command, and she is serving him, so he has all wealth. So why would he have to beg? And if he does beg, that puts him in a begging, of course, is not a very honorable profession. At least for the higher castes, maybe a sudra can beg or something, but not very honorable in most cases. A sannyasi can beg, yes, he can do that. A brahmachari can beg, but a grihastha shouldn't beg. So begging is not considered so good for most people. Yet Krishna goes out and begs like this, and he's the Supreme Lord. So not a very honorable profession for him or honorable act. And of course he doesn't need anything anyway. But he does this. And what is the ultimate reason? And of course the reason is to give pleasure to his devotees and give service to his devotees. So he gives service to the wives of the brahmanas. And in this way they become very, very joyful and they engage in offering everything to Krishna. So that begging gives an opportunity to the devotees to serve him. And at the same time, and gives an opportunity for the materialists in the form of the brahmanas to realize their big mistake and become purified. So in other words, this action of begging also stimulates the brahmanas to repent for their foolishness and realize the contrary qualities of the Supreme Lord in the form of Krishna, and they begin to appreciate that. So that is actually what is expressed here. Of course, Shri refers to Lakshmi, and then if Shri is there, then Vishnu must be there. So they're equating, more we can say in one sense, they're equating Krishna with the Supreme Lord as Vishnu, and then he has Shri as his command. So they have, you can say, a lesser realization of the Supreme Lord Krishna, because they see him in his powerful aspect as well as his form as a boy. So it's more or less like the people of Mathura. They see Krishna as their relative, etc., but they also see him as God. And they understand he has all powers. Of course, a Shri can also mean the gopis in Vrindavan. For instance, Lakshmi Sahasrara Sambhrama Sevyamanam. There, Lakshmi means not Lakshmi in Vaikuntha, but the gopis in Vrindavan. And Shri, of course, ultimately can mean Radha. She is the ultimate Shri, because she has all powers and all qualities and all wealth and all beauty, etc. Whatever is in Lakshmi is also in Radha, plus Radha has extra things. And whatever is in Lakshmi is also in Durga Devi, but Durga Devi has less than Lakshmi. So the ultimate, the highest form of Shri is Radha, and then the gopis, and then Lakshmi. So therefore, this can also refer to the gopis and to Lakshmi herself. And so therefore, Krishna is served by the gopis and by Radha, who have all wealth at their command. The other point, of course, is that if we take Shri as referring to Lakshmi in Vaikuntha, and Krishna as Krishna in Vrindavan, then we can say that Shri aspires to touch the lotus feet of Krishna. And that's what it says here, asaya, parasparsha asaya, the desire to touch the feet of Krishna. And she has that desire constantly, and therefore she worships him. So what this means, can mean, is that yes, Lakshmi aspires to attain Krishna and she worships him, but actually she can't. Because she is Lakshmi of Vaikuntha. And Lakshmi of Vaikuntha is not permitted in the pastimes of Krishna and Vrindavan. So that was pointed out by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Venkat Bhatta in Sri Rangam. They would often discuss about Krishna and Vishnu, because the worshippers of at Sri Rangam of Vishnu are members of Ramanuja Sampradaya, and they take Vishnu as supreme and Lakshmi as the consort of Vishnu. Whereas Lord Chaitanya, when he stayed there for 4 months, he was always talking about Krishna. And he said, Krishna is supreme. So they would often have discussions about who is better, Vishnu or Krishna. So one time Lord Chaitanya, he gave the argument, of course quoting from the Puranas and from Bhagavatam, to say that when Krishna has his pastimes in Vrindavan, and particularly when he has the Ras Lila, then even Lakshmi becomes attracted to that form of Krishna. And she desires, I would also like to participate in the Ras Lila. So, if Lakshmi is supreme and Vishnu is supreme as consort, the husband, as Supreme Lord, then why would she become attracted to Krishna, who would be a secondary expansion of Vishnu? Vishnu should have all powers. So how can Lakshmi become attracted to Krishna instead of to Vishnu, if Vishnu is supreme? And more than that, then he in Bhagavatam it says that actually Lakshmi aspires for association with Krishna, but she cannot do so. It's only an aspiration. She cannot enter into the pastimes of Krishna. Mm-hmm. So Lord Chaitanya said this to Venkat Bhatta. Actually, Lakshmi aspires for this, and even though she's the chaste wife of Vishnu, somehow or other, she becomes attracted to Krishna. So that must show his power. Furthermore, because she is the consort of Vishnu, she should be able to go anywhere. Because Vishnu is more powerful. But she can't enter into Krishna's pastimes. What does that mean? She's not on the level of the gopis. The gopis can associate with Krishna and the Rasa Leela and Radharani can, but she can't. So she's not in the same position. So in this way, Lord Chaitanya showed that Krishna is supreme, and his associates in Vrindavan, including the gopis and Radha, they are in the supreme position. And Vishnu is secondary with Lakshmi and all the persons of Vaikuntha. So in other places this is stated that Sri aspires, Lakshmi aspires for the lotus feet of Krishna, but unfortunately she can never get into those pastimes. And he said, because she is not the proper form. She is a form suitable for Vishnu only. And she cannot enter into the pastimes of Krishna because she does not have the body of a gopi. Doesn't have that proper form. So she cannot enter in. So therefore the gopis' bodies, spiritual bodies, are superior to the bodies of Lakshmi's in Vaikuntha. Even though, of course, you say Lakshmi is full of all opulence. The bodies of the gopis have more opulence. They're more qualified. More complete. More beautiful. So in this way, Lord Chaitanya showed the superiority of Krishna and the gopis to Vishnu and Lakshmi. So that also slightly indicated here in this verse where the Brahmanas say that the goddess of fortune worships Krishna to get the touch of his lotus feet. In any case, because Krishna has all opulence and wealth and beauty and every good quality at his command, it seems impossible that he could beg, but yet he does beg. So this is the all this is accommodated within the Achintya Shakti of the Lord. He has all wonderful qualities, and one of his qualities is that he has Achintya Shakti, so he can do opposites. Achintya, of course, means inconceivable. Inconceivable means that he does what the Lord has the power to do what is impossible. And what is impossible is to do what is contrary. What is opposite. So if the Lord has all power, how could he be powerless? If the Lord has all control of everything, how can he be fearful? If the Lord is all attractive, how can he be most attracted to Radha? Radha controls Krishna by her attractive nature. And Krishna is called the most attractive. So these are like opposites. How is it possible? But the Achintya Shakti will solve that problem. Both things can exist within Krishna. He can be powerful but powerless, and fearless but fearful, and most attractive but most attracted to Radha. That is his nature. So therefore, it says, Jana Mohini, he is most astonishing and most bewildering to all people of this world. When he does acts like this, they cannot figure it out. And it's particularly for Krishna, because Krishna acts like a normal human being. And he acts more like a human being than any other form of God. When he should be God, you know? So he acts like a human being. So it becomes confusing for people. Okay.
There are different kinds of mantras, like eight different mantras.
Say, Chennai, there's a temple. Yeah, Salakshmi. Yeah.
What are their position? Are they spiritual?
Well, these Lakshmis are for, if you look at them, one is for freedom from disease, yeah. One is for food, one is for vehicles, one is for children, one is for, what's another one?
Fighting.
education, vidya. And vidya is one, education. Like all the things you want in the material world. There's eight Lakshmis for this. So obviously they're more like Durga expansions, material expansions, not the Supreme Lakshmi. Of course, in that temple they do have Vishnu and Lakshmi there also, but when people, generally these are for people of the material world, this type of worship. So they worship Vishnu and Lakshmi for material things, and therefore she has these forms which are more or less expansions for material benedictions in this world. So they're secondary expansions.
In view of everything that you said, why do you think the Lord bothers with all of this? Because he's such an Ananda and he's Atmanam, so why does he expand and have all these leaders?
Oh, yeah. That topic comes up in the Vedanta Sutra. The Lord is independent and everything. So why is there anybody else at all? Because he should just exist alone, and he's independent and he's full of bliss. So why is there anything? Why is there jivas at all? And why is there a spiritual world? So the answer is because of bliss. Everything is an expression of his bliss. And of course, nothing is temporary. Everything is eternal, so there's no real creation as such of anything. Jivas are all eternal. Spiritual world is eternal. Even matter is eternal. So why does everything else other than Krishna exist if he is independent? Because it is an expression of his bliss. The Lord is blissful, and everything else is an expression of his bliss. What that means is that, in other words, that bliss is expressed ideally by relationships of love between two persons. So therefore, we have Krishna and we have to have somebody else. That's the expression of love. So therefore, we have the first expansion as Radha, so to speak, Shakti. Or Vishnu for Lakshmi, etc. So they are, and of course their expansions in the gopis, etc. And then in the jivas in general. All this is simply an expression of bliss. There's no particular cause, but the Lord is full of bliss, so the expression of that bliss is all the jivas and all the shaktis, everything in the spiritual world. And then it's a result of interaction between the Lord and his Shakti or Jivas, etc. Then we get further increase in bliss. So it's an aspect of bliss, the expansion. That is a response to the in the Upanishads. It says the Lord said, I will become many Bahusham. In Chandogya Upanishad, like that very famous statement, I become many. So why does the Lord become many when he's already full in himself? So the answer is Ananda taught. Because of bliss, because of his blissful nature, he is many.
What kind of bliss then is experienced in the material world?
That's a secondary aspect. Yeah, and why does the material world exist? If it's an expression of bliss of the Lord, does the Lord get bliss from seeing the distress of the living entities in the material world? No. It is bliss in the sense that the existence of the jiva, of the jivas, infinite number of jivas, is an expression of his bliss. But then we can say, well, we have jivas in the material world and spiritual world, they'll also be in the spiritual world. The answer to that is that the definition of jiva is an partially independent particle who has his own consciousness, a separate identity from the Lord and from every other jiva. So each one is an individual with individual consciousness and differences. So therefore, among all the jivas, we'll have differences. And therefore, some are in the spiritual world, some are in the material world because of difference, which is inherent in the nature of the jiva. They're all different. So some will be more, we can say, more qualified than others. And then to satisfy these jivas in the material world with their particular types of desires, then the Lord gives this particular world with the option that by the rebirth and rebirth, and then the aspects of karma, etc., and the Lord coming in the material world and giving scripture and association and sending devotees, that these jivas here will attain real bliss as a result of their experiences in the world. So that attainment of the bliss, actual bliss, by becoming Krishna conscious, that's the blissful aspect for the Lord when that happens. The other aspect why they're here is the aspect of, because they are infinite number of jivas with infinite number of varieties.
Suffering is not bliss.
No, that is definitely not. And nor does the Lord appreciate it. Therefore, he makes the world in such a way to try to educate us. Now, the unfortunate position of the jivas is that they don't care. Let me suffer, but let me stay in the material world anyway. Let me suffer, but let me stay here, and I think I'll enjoy at least. So they never want to give up that propensity, therefore they stay here. And when they give up that idea, that it's not so nice after all, and maybe it's better serving the Lord and giving up this complete independence, then the Lord says, okay, fine, and lets them out, and he's blissful with that.
An example of Lord Chaitanya when he comes to the material world of this Achinchish potency, the opposites you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, he is like Krishna also shows, I said, he shows more of this Chintya Shakti because he appears as human like and doesn't show his power so much and acts like a human being and seems to grow like a child and everything, even though he's eternal. How can he have a birth and then grow and go through three different ages if he's eternal in form? That's also weird. Anyway, I guess our acharyas explain that. So Lord Chaitanya also is taking the form of a devotee, actually. And again, he's also very similar to Krishna because he has the mood of Krishna, but he's in the mood of Radha. So that also becomes rather inexplainable because the Supreme Lord takes the form of a devotee and acts like a devotee, like Radha, and takes on the sentiments of a worshipper of Krishna. So why should he do that? And then, of course, Chaitanya Charitamrita answers, because Krishna, when he sees Radha, wonders, what is the greatness of her love? What is the sweetness of her love? And what is it she sees in me which is so wonderful? Now, of course, we can say, well, Krishna's omniscient, so he knows everything, so he knows all that automatically. But on the other hand, he said, what is this? How is she like this? So that we can say, that's inconceivable why he does that. He comes in the material world and he experiences like Radha as a devotee for that purpose.
Should
they?
Yeah.
How do we? Well, we respect all forms of God, but of course, just like in Brahma Samhita, everything is related to Govinda, and everything else is secondary. That Mahavishnu and Shiva and everybody else, and all the different forms, Ganesh, etc., and Narasimha, they were all secondary to Krishna. That is our philosophical stance, that Krishna is complete. He is Purnatama, the most complete form of God. But at the same time, we do not insult or degrade or in any way think of the other forms of God as not God. They are all God, and they're all perfect. So it becomes a matter simply of taste, which form you particularly have an attraction for. And every jiva will be different. Every devotee will be different. So some are Nrsimha Bhaktas, some are Ram Bhaktas, some are Krishna Bhaktas, some are Vishnu Bhaktas, etc. And even with Krishna, different rasas are there. And we say Madhurya Rasa is supreme, but yes, some will be Dasas, and some will be Sakya Rasa, some will be Vatsalya Rasa, even though the intensity of the relationship is not so great as in Madhurya Rasa. Yet, there'll be all these, according to preference and attraction, devotees will take different roles and see Krishna differently, even Krishna. So this is all according to the devotee. You may have a tendency to appreciate Narasimhadeva or Rama or Vishnu rather than Krishna, and nothing can really be done about that. So that is why Lord Chaitanya also did not interfere with the worship of the Vaishnavas in Sri Ranga, even though he said, well, Krishna is superior, and of course he's the Supreme Lord also, Lord Chaitanya. And he said, okay, you're worshipping Vishnu. They would argue in a friendly way, but then he wouldn't push them any further. And so he let them worship. And of course he had Murari Gupta was a Ram Bhakta, and Anupam also, the brother of Sanatana Rupa, he was a Ram Bhakta. And they could not give up their worship of Rama for Krishna, even though Lord Chaitanya is saying Krishna is the most wonderful, etc. They did not give up. And Lord Chaitanya didn't force them. He allowed them to worship Rama, even though they were his devotees also, and they were, you know, associating very closely with Lord Chaitanya. They never gave up that worship of Rama. So, even in Lord Chaitanya Leela, some of the devotees were not worshipping Radha Krishna, all of them. But philosophically, we take that as the highest position. But even there, we'll find people maybe worshipping other things, other rasas, etc., even within the Gaudiya Sampradaya.
In our worship, we worship Radha Krishna even in the middle.
In Vaidhi Bhakti.
Yeah, in the sense that we offer respect and
Our
worship is offered in the mood of reverence. So, in one sense, we don't have to change anything when we're dealing with others. If we're appropriately respectful like that, then we can satisfy everybody.
But some people may have an attraction for a different form other than Radha Krishna, whatever. So yeah, we respect all the forms. Now we also, because we're doing Vaidhi Bhakti, then we worship Radha and Krishna, but we're doing that according to Vaidhi Bhakti, that is rules and regulations, and we see him as God, and we give respect, etc. This is the form we operate on. But of course in Chaitanya Charitamrita is mentioned there that if you actually want to go to Gokul in the spiritual world and have that spontaneous relationship with Krishna, you have to develop that spontaneous mood through Raghunuga Bhakti ultimately. So you would have to progress to that to get there. And in the commentary of, I think it's Vishwanath, on the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu there, he says that if you worship, of course, Dwarka Krishna, and you prefer Dwarka Krishna to Radha Krishna, or you even worship Radha Krishna but you use some Dwarka type mantras and you worship the queens also, then you go to Dwarka in the spiritual world instead because of your attraction for that form of Krishna and the queens. But he says, what if you worship Radha and Krishna but you worship only in Vaidhi Bhakti in your sadhana, and then you go to Bhava and then you go to Prema? Obviously you can't go to Dwarka because of that. But then again, you cannot go to Gokul in the spiritual world also because of that Vaidhi influence, which influenced your Bhava and Prema also, so there's some restriction there. So it says you go to another place called Aishwarya Goloka, which is like Raja, but everybody worships Krishna with reverence there. Whereas in Vrindavan, they don't see Krishna as God at all, and they treat him as a small child and like that. So that mood has to be developed, and that goes through Raghunuga Bhakti and then through to Bhava and Prema.
Well,
generally the Raghunuga is done internally. It may be done externally to some degree. But of course, temple worship in general is more or less Vaidhi. So in public temples especially, you cannot do Raghunuga Bhakti. So it may be private worship that you have, or internal worship. That is how Raghunuga usually develops. So it's an internal process. Actually, Shivaram Swami gave a little presentation to the GBC. Were you there for that part? So he was kind of mentioning it. Anyway, even though we are nominally doing Vaidhi Bhakti in one sense, in ISKCON and everything like that, at the same time, it is more or less Raghunuga oriented in the sense that our main deities are Radha Krishna. And we have the form of Radha and Krishna. And these are the deities we see, the forms. And we hear about the pastimes of Krishna because Bhagavatam is there. And we understand this. So there is a, and of course, even in our deity worship, the rules are much less than most other sampradayas, like the Sri Sampradaya, the Madhva Sampradaya. Their Vaidhi Bhakti is quite Vaidhi compared to us. And our rules are much lax. Probably the only relaxed sampradaya, maybe the Vallabhas. They're kind of spontaneous in their approach to worship also. And so our rules and regulations are much less because of that, even though we do have practicing Vaidya Bhakti, the rules and regulation aspect is much less because of the influence of the raga sentiment of Lord Chaitanya. So therefore, as one progresses, even though we have the external worship and everything else, internally one can also practice at the same time with the hearing and chanting, etc.
I think what about also the devotee in chanting Vaidya Bhakti becomes enthusiastic to just render service. And you know, whatever the service may be, the enthusiasm and the attraction for Krishna becomes more and more and more.
Yeah.
So that the dependence is not then on rules and regulations, but just on the fact that he's inspired to do that.
Well, where that develops and develops, to the extent that, and we cultivate this mood of the devotees in Vrindavan, then that will become Raganuga Bhakti, because basically the definition of Raganuga is to follow after those who have Raga, that is, the associates of Vrindavan, and aspire to act in the same way. Even though this, we're not qualified at this stage, you know. Raganuga is also a sadhana, so it's only a practice. Yeah.
In that section of the next version, Prabhupada mentions that sometimes it's seen that the raga nuga bhaktas don't follow the ordinary principles. Second page, Prabhupada says, but those who are following should follow the ordinary principles.
There's a big commentary on that, I think, by Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath on this aspect of following or not following. And some arguments are given, well, we will not observe a codicil because the people of Vrindavan don't observe a codicil. This is some, and we will not follow because we want to be spontaneous like them. And we will not chant our rounds or whatever you could say, you know, because they're not getting up in the morning and chanting japa and all this like that. So we won't do this also. But he said, no, this is a false concept. And then he points to a verse of Rupa Goswami where it says, we follow after the inhabitants of Vrindavan and after the followers of them. So the followers of them means the acharyas. So we should follow after the acharyas also. So Vishwanath says that means we follow the example of Rupa Goswami. So externally we will follow their example. And they observe the codicil. They observe so many things. So we will follow after their example. And internally, we will cultivate that type of relationship with Krishna.
I'll just think about that on the last couple of days. My understanding is that the first reference is to the residents of Vrindavan who are following the real Raga Bhakti. But the second reference is to those who are following the rules and regulations in devotional service. But maybe then developing that movement spontaneity. But
still, they have to follow the rules and regulations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not contradictory.
No.
Yeah.
Practice.
Yeah. There's a comment about Bhaktivinoda Kaur where he says that those on that platform may choose to follow or not to follow.
Of course, they can, but generally the acharyas will follow. So we follow after them. Of course, when they get high, it may be impossible for them due to their. You know, when they go up to bhava and prema, then you cannot predict what they're going to do. And actually, Rupa Goswami says in relation to prema, the prema bhakti we will not describe because you cannot predict what he's going to do. You don't know what he's going to do. And you're completely beyond the world. And Lord Chaitanya was like that in Puri. You know, he was completely uncontrolled. Not related to his material body anymore.
One of the things I was thinking of, you know, rules and regulations, just like the gopis would go and associate with Krishna in the forest at night, which is against the rules, which is against the rules. So in that sense, they break the rules.
But that, of course, is a very high level, and ultimately, of course, our acharyas say that they were so-called married. But they were not touched by their husbands. So they're not really married after all.
There was one comment I read yesterday. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and he was saying that because of Vaishnava, as they become advanced, they develop humility and they never actually consider themselves to be the Vaishnava, let alone an element of Vaishnava, and therefore they even if they are qualified, they never consider giving up the rigor and principles because they're considering themselves not advanced.
But yeah, actually they're not attached to the material world, anything in the material world. There's no question of breaking any regulative principle like that. But they may not follow in the same way that we think. That's why. And their acts may look like they're doing something, and they're not. So example is given of Nityananda. Nityananda goes into the liquor shop. So he says, Nityananda's going to get intoxicated. But he goes there to deliver the fallen souls, actually. But he, normally one should not go in a liquor store just because of the contamination and the bad atmosphere and whatever, And of course, the bad name you get. Yeah? Well, he doesn't care. Yeah? So we can't really judge the activities of a exalted devotee, what they're going to do, because they have different intentions than us. And then they go do what seem to be weird activities, but we can't judge them. And similarly, someone like Bhamsi Das Babaji that did not have the same rules for worshipping his deity. He would take them down to the river and dunk them in the river and pull them out and offer them rye plants. And we'll say, well, what kind of devotion is this? But internally, of course, something else was going on in his mind. But we can't judge that.
You said, in the MISKCON there are many different varieties of devotees. And it's more geared towards, of course, Vaidhi, plus also whatever Shivaram Swami said. I understand that. Asking is most of the devotees comes in a certain pattern, like follow a certain pattern. Like everyone associates with the temple devotees, and they have a certain sadhana, but there are, we've seen some cases where they have attachment to their own beings. They're not able to mix. They're not able to very well mix with the general. Set of devotees. Most of the devotees are able to mix and go along with the satsang and stuff like that. But we see that they definitely have some deep attachment to the deity worship. So how can we sort of judge them? Is it right to say that they're neophytes because they're not able to mix with the devotees? But we can see that they are pretty attached.
Well, of course, even among devotees, there will be different types of devotees also, and we can't really unnaturally force people into one category or the other. Some may be more introverted, some are more extroverted, etc. The only way we can measure this, of course, if they are neophyte, is that if they isolate themselves and they begin to disrespect devotees, then that's a bad sign. If they are just simply by nature rather introverted and they are attached to their deity, there's nothing wrong with that. As long as they're not negative towards devotees or whatever, or that they try to avoid necessarily devotees. Huh? And the other point, of course, is by devotional association of some sort that one develops and gets mercy. So they may not associate with all the devotees all the time, but as long as there's some devotion and some association there by which they can get mercy and develop, and that should be there.
For example, some devotees do not have much attachment to deity worship, but they are just sort of, they like to do preaching or other sort of activities.
Yeah.
But actually, there is no real deep attachment to deity worship. How do we say that? Is that a neophyte state or it's not?
Different devotees may have different attraction to different types of service. In any case, whether it is deity worship or whether it is chanting the holy name or whether it is cooking or whatever, in any case, and they're engaging, we can say their material propensities for action or what, peacefulness or whatever, or intellectual work, whatever, that's one thing. But in any case, they're all good. But at the same time, they can't forget that it has to be related to Krishna. And ultimately, it is selfless service to Krishna. Anya abhilasha shunya gyan karmin avartam. If they kind of forget they're cultivating a relationship with Krishna, and then it becomes again material. So they're all good activities according to the person's capacity. It has to relate to Krishna.
Maharaj, the gopi, as I understand, are nitya siddhas.
Not all of them.
No.
Some are aspiring to become nitya. There are sadhana siddhas also. There are sadhana siddha gopis. Like the Upanishads were sadhana siddha gopis who aspired. The prayers of the personified Vedas, they say, we aspire to, you know, have a relationship like the gopis in Vrindavan for Krishna. So then Krishna blessed them, and then they became perfect when Krishna appeared. Or the sages of Dandakaranya also, they were sadhana siddhas. Okay, Hare Krishna.